on the AM and FM 107 Radio Network, broadcasting from AM and FM stations around the country. Welcome to the Small Business Administration award-winning School for Startups Radio, where we talk all things small business and entrepreneurship. Now, here is your host, the guy that believes anyone can be a successful entrepreneur because entrepreneurship is not about creativity, risk, or passion, Jim Beach.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another exciting edition of School for Startups Radio. I sure do appreciate you being with us as always, because we put together a fantastic show for you. First up today, we have Margaret Moore. She has written a new book on the science of leadership and how to expand your impact through better leadership. Absolutely great stuff, really interesting, and we have a great conversation. I'm excited for you to hear it. We talk about ego and all sorts of other things that are related to your leadership, and so I think you will benefit from that. After that, we have another greatest hit. You listeners are probably too young to know this, but there used to be a famous American prankster named Alan Abel. During the interview, we talk about some of his famous pranks, so I don't want to spoil that now. But it's a great show. We're going to go ahead and get started right now. Here we go. You know, being a leader is so very hard, and part of the biggest problem is your ego, I bet. I know I have dealt with that. I have someone who's going to help us learn how to be better at this issue. Please welcome Margaret Moore to the show. She did, I think, about 17 years working in corporate and has gone out and become one of the premier coaches in the country. She has just written a new book that we're going to be talking about called The Science of Leadership: 9 Ways to Expand Your Impact. And she has been, as I said, very active in the coaching space. She has created 3 international coaching associations to help bring clarity and definition to the industry. Margaret Moore, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
Thank you, Jim. I'm great. It's just a delight to be here with you.
You know, Margaret, in my state, it's easier to become a coach than a esthetician. Is that how you say that word?
That's right. Yes, esthetician. Yeah.
It's harder to learn how to pull hair with tweezers than to become a coach.
Yes. Well, that's if you ignore all the credentialing organizations and the hard work that's been done to build standards. So, you know, there's no license. You don't have to. No, that's true. But, you know, when any new profession starts, that's how it happens, right? It starts with a few people working real hard to rise above the fray and all their competitors and create standards. And then you build national credentials, and then the states decide to license. It's been going on for a couple hundred years, right? I think physician standards started 100 years ago, a little more than that. So yeah, it's just the natural order of things that when a new profession comes along, it just has to go through these stages, and coaching hasn't quite grown up.
What is the biggest problem with the coaching world?
Well, and that's really why we wrote the book. You know, my first career was in biotechnology. I'm a biology and a biologist and an MBA. And I happen to enjoy science a lot. I mean, both my husbands have been scientists, not at the same time. I just really enjoy the scientific process. And when I started the first coaching school in healthcare 20 years ago, I quickly realized that even though there was a huge amount of science called health psychology, sports psychology, and coaching psychology was just getting started, coaches were not getting educated in what works. And the researchers work very hard to find something close to the objective truth. You know, like, how do humans change? What does well-being look like? What does leadership look like? And you have these thousands and thousands of scientists toiling away. All their work is tucked away in journals, and it never, and they live in their own world, and it never gets out to the rest of us. So my passion is to read this. You know, these articles aren't easy to read. They really are. They give you a headache. It's a painful process. But if you go looking for the gems, you find them. And so I've just made it my job to get to find the fabulous science from these very low ego scientists, and then translated in a way that people can get, oh, I get that. And then how do I use it? So that's kind of my sweet spot.
All right. That makes sense. I like that. All right. Tell us about the book, Science of Leadership.
Well, so I went to MBA school, in Canada. I'm a Canadian, 40 years ago. And I loved the leadership. And back then we had one book, Michael Porter's Competitive Strategy. Maybe you remember it.
Oh, I'm so tired of that book.
That's all we had. Yep. And so, all these years later, I've been touching the science of leadership. But in fact, when we put the survey out in the book title, we had a few options, and our editor threw in the science of leadership. That was like a tall order, right? I mean, there's a lot of it. And so it turned out that 67% of the people who filled out the survey said, we want this title. We want the science of leadership. It's not available to us. And so we dug in, and I had a good framework. That's a separate story, around how the mind is organized into a set of pretty universal parts. So I had a map for wading through it. And then it was, there might be like 100 topics in leadership research, each with hundreds and hundreds of studies, and then lots of little topics. And so it was a question of kind of going through it all, sorting it all out, finding the best studies. Like now, 40 years later, we don't just have one study on humility of leadership. We have 212 that are reported in one review. So you can read the reviews that do this pretty complicated math, assessing all the studies, and then they arrive at the clearer signals of what's working, because one study can mislead you. So we're at that place now where we have hundreds of studies across many topics. And then when you get into them, you find, wow, like what's here is not what people understand. And so then it becomes a joy of like finding a way to knit it all together and then present it in a way that people can digest it and say, oh, wow, that's really interesting.
All right. What were some of the takeaways then? Or I guess those are the 9 points. Scoured all of the data and kind of willowed it down for us. What were the takeaways?
Well, we've landed on 9 leadership capacities. That's the first thing. And we organized them into 3 stages. So, one is self. We all have to lead ourselves, right? That's kind of universal. And they all apply at the level of self. Then you have others. And we all have others in our lives who we might be parenting, coaching, mentoring. And so all of us, that's relevant to all of us. But what really makes leaders distinct is as leaders, we have to actually ripple out and affect a whole system, a team, a whole organization, a community. And how you then do that is take those capacities and then have them like disseminate, blow out like the wind. That's what really distinguishes good leaders from others, is their ability to do that.
Self, other, system, correct?
That's it.
That spells SOS.
Well, that's what most of us feel today as leaders. Help.
It is, yes. Yes.
Yeah.
All right. So let's go back through them and dig in a little bit more. I think there's 3 principles for each, right? So the self-orientation.
Yeah, there's a few. Okay. Yeah.
Walk us through in more depth the self-oriented. It sounds like this is a little bit like emotional intelligence.
Yeah. So emotional intelligence is a good example of a framework that has 2 parts to it. Self, your own emotions, and then social intelligence, the others, right? Yeah. So we separated them into 2. So we put the relational stuff into relational leadership, and we put the self-oriented stuff into conscious leadership. Conscious leadership is a topic, but we rebranded it because conscious is really about, seeing things clearly, which means, with all that mental and emotional activity going on, our noisy egos in our heads, that all gets in the way. It's like driving through the rain. You can't see things clearly when your mind is giving you, it's like how AI works. It keeps generating all this stuff. And then you don't actually see what's in front of you. You don't see the situation clearly. So conscious leadership is really about setting aside the mental and emotional human, self-oriented stuff, and actually, like in Taoism, it's called the mountain. You see, you're still, you're calm, you're clear, you move, you know, deliberately, you know where to go, you see things clearly. So that's how what we described as conscious. And then the next, authentic, which is a big topic. But interestingly, the research is different than the way we think about it. People talk about authentic leadership, like you just got to be yourself, you know, let it all hang out. And it turns out that
it's about caring, authentic, isn't it?
It's about caring. It's actually about what you value, your higher self, your best self. But what's interesting in the big analyses is that when you know what you care about, so you have a purpose for your work, you know, your heart's in it. You know, there's some legacy. It's not just about making money. That's important. But there's something bigger than that, that literally lifts you off your feet. But what that is good for you to be authentic, that you know what you care about and you value and you live by that. But what improves others' results and organizational results is not that. It's that you care as the leader about what others care about. And you bring that together into sort of a cohesive, unified purpose. So your team is all sharing that purpose. Being authentic is good for you, but what's good for the other people is you care about them being authentic. And that's not obvious from, you know, the lay books and experts.
Right.
And then the third one is agility. And there, you know, you might remember this Agile manifesto from 20 years ago when a bunch of software people got together and a ski resort. And you know, it's
all
not been studied.
Great
very
ideas
much.
Come from ski resorts, Margaret.
Yeah, as long as you don't break your leg. Yeah. Maybe better if you do. But agility, it turns out I'd written about this in another book. There's a wonderful textbook called The Agile Mind by a Harvard neuroscientist, Wilma Kutstall, who's not very famous, and her book is like 3 inches thick. But you get the idea that agility is your ability to move your mind around, like from creative to deep thought to big picture to precise details. And agility is emotional agility, psychological agility, it's resilience, it's being curious and not being a know-it-all, it's, you know, dealing with polarities. Like, agility is everywhere, and it's hard. You know, it's hard to keep like changing channels and switching tasks. And so we really build that out into a much bigger idea that gets leaders to realize just how agile they have to be, which one thing to another. And multitasking is the worst for this. You end up consuming your brain energy very quickly. Your frontal cortex gets pooped out. You need to sleep. You need to exercise. You need to eat well. So agility is, you know, a really important thing. It's what drives entrepreneurs. You know, in Taoism, it's the thunder, you know, shake things up. So that's a very core capacity for yourself. So that rounds out the first three: seeing clearly, caring, and flexing.
All right. The next three are in the other oriented category.
Yes. Yeah. So now you got to get out of yourself. So they're relational, which is to help. So you already care, right? Now you're helping. And then to strengthen, that's positive leadership. And then compassion is resonating. Okay. So relational is, I don't know about you, Jim, but you know, what people don't really realize that our relationships at work are really meaningful if you want them to be. And if you do, and you have like this real resonance with people, so you actually enjoy the relationship and you start, you know, with the how are you really? And what's happening? And what's going on for you? And what do you need right now? And then, okay, now we get to the work. That attunement at a heart level improves the actual thinking, the collaborative, you know, creative stuff. So it's this attuning to people first, feeling, you know, being in your, you know, feeler state. If you know Myers-Briggs, you're feeling rather than thinking, and then moving to the thinking. And when you do that, people trust you more. They go where you want them to go. And then you have a better idea of how to help them. And so one thing we learned from the research is that most people don't want to be helped very much. And leaders can overdo it, you know, the micromanaging, you know, like on top of people. And it turns out that you really need to know how people want to be helped. And generally, they want to be helped when they get in trouble. They have a conflict. They can't, you know, there's a roadblock. And then you step in and you put on your cape and you're superwoman for the moment and you fix things. But most of the time, you don't do that. So that's relational. And then positive psychology is all about strength. So it's confidence, it's agency, it's optimism, it's, you know, positive experiences. That positive psychology has given us such a gift in understanding how to make people more confident and competent. And that's really important for leaders, is to help people, you know, be more confident and competent and upbeat and all of that. And then compassion's kind of a new kid on the block. Compassion science isn't very old. And this is kind of the beginning of strategy, because compassion is that you actually understand all of the forces operating on your organization, people, you know, stakeholders, and understanding what they need, and then building a resonant vision, purpose, strategy from that place of compassion. So that's the other.
Okay. And then the third system.
So now we get to the toughest ones. So sharing, which means teaching others how to lead, and then at scale across the organization, and then servant leadership, which is the quiet ego on steroids, you know, when you're really in a place of service and you just don't think about yourself very much. And then my favorite, the biggest one, is transformation, which is that people are changed. You know, dramatically, their identities change, their behaviors change, their feelings, their thoughts, the products and services change. So those are the three. The sharing is tough. I mean, I've done a couple of audience surveys online with the book, and shared leadership ranks at the lowest. Most people don't know how to help other people lead. You know, that's where you have leadership development and training programs. That's a tough one, because you have to really. There's a great case study in a large insurance industry in Europe, where a CEO arrived, turnaround situation, company was failing, stockholders were upset. He had like 4 months to turn things around, and he decided to put together a group of about 40 frontline employees who knew nothing about corporate strategy, had never met a CEO before, you know, and they got screened, and then they went through a 4-month process to be able to contribute to the strategic plan. And the CEO was kind of bored and, you know, distracted half the time, because the employees really didn't know how to talk his language. And eventually they got to middle ground, and a third of what these frontline people did ended up in the strategic plan. You know, the company went up in $18 billion in value. And anyway, it's a really good story, because the CEO had to work for months weekly with these people to get them to talk the language of the corporate, you know, C-suite office. So that's a tough one. Servant leadership's tough, because, you know, you don't need to be Mother Teresa, but you do have to be in a place of maturity where you can put other people first while you do everything else. So, you know, that's kind of a nice thing to get to when you're maybe in your 60s and 70s. Most of us don't get there until our egos kind of break down with aging and, you know, all the things that happen that loosen up the pins that hold our egos together. And then transformational is really about getting people to see things differently, think differently. And that's a process of challenging people, stretching them, having them challenging their perspectives, getting them to see things they've never seen. You know, it's a lot of agility. And so transformational leaders, I mean, that's the folks, you know, the Musks and all the folks out there that we know, that they're capable of getting a group of people to completely shift the way they operate. So that's the nine.
All right. You mentioned noisy ego and quieting your ego, I think, three times. Tell us what noisy ego means.
So the noisy ego is the internal chatter in your mind about your whatever, about yourself, your work, your task. You know, when you have a meeting and you're like, you're sort of like, you're doing a little back channel with someone, I'll text, you know, can you believe that person did that? And like, you know, what are they trying to do? And all of that, like, all that's all ego noise. you know, and we do it all, venting, you know, you go out for drinks, you vent, that's all ego noise. So all the yang, 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 all the like lower self stuff. The higher self stuff is a quiet ego. You simply there and present and participating fully. Your undivided attention, you're just in the flow of the situation. So those are the differences. One is you're just, you know, you've got all this internal chatter. So leaders don't get, you know, don't get off easy with ego noise, because, you know, as you take on more responsibility, there's further to fall, right? It's more scary. The more people, the more, you know, the bigger the budgets, the bigger the stakes. And so you might like portray this confidence and strength in the daytime, and then you get home, or, you know, at the middle of the night, you're like in panic attack, or just like waking up worrying. That's ego noise. And in the leadership context, it's called a shadow. It's like you convey this sunny confidence, and then, but on the other side is like fear and worry and anxiety. And what makes leaders more effective is that they understand that that noise has a destiny, which isn't just managing the stress. It's actually going to get turned into strength. That's how resilience works. You go through something tough. It's a natural process that happens during sleep. In coaching, we try to make it happen more consistently and more rapidly. But it's when you take the suffering, broadly speaking, and you turn it into something good. And, you know, we all go through that, right? Like, you can remember yourself a year ago, 10 years ago, when things that stressed you out then don't now. So that's what happened. You integrated that into more strength. So if leaders have good practices to help make that happen, then their noisy ego will eventually get quieter.
Eventually. Is there anything I could do proactively now?
For you, you mean to quiet your ego?
Right.
Yeah. So in the book, we teach it's a very nice mindfulness framework. The first step is self-awareness. So notice that your mind, your core of your mind, can step back from it to observe it. You know, that's what mindfulness is all about. Just that, creating a distance between the frenzy and, like, so it's not like, I'm frenzy. It's, there's a part of me that's stressed right now. That's interesting. So that part of your brain that's able to watch yourself doesn't mature to your late 20s. So you're probably past that. So step one is just to know that you can create like a distance between you and that emotional like noise. So that's the first one. Then self-regulation is the second step, which is that, there's the ego noise, you know, the anger, the whatever. And you can learn how to set it aside and go back to your calm state. And you can get there just with a couple of deep breaths. If it's really sticky, like Velcro, you know, you might have to go for a walk. You might have to do something else to loosen it up. And then the transcendence, I have a practice to do that. We don't have time to go through it, but there's, you know, it is a natural process where your brain wants to trend. What happens is that you have a brain network that says, "This, I'm scared. I'm worried about this." And another brain network that says, you know, you can do this. Or here's how to do it. Or go get help here. And the neuroplasticity part is the network that knows the answer joins with the network that's struggling. And then you calm down. So that's how it works. It's actually, and there have been coaching studies that show that when you get that insight, that moment when the strain settles, there's activity at behind the right ear where the nonlinear creative centers are. So like association, things get connected, and also your brain frequencies drop down. So you calm down. So that moment of insight, that calming, it's a natural state, and you just trust that that's going to happen, and then you transcend the noise.
So when we have a moment of extreme stress or just any kind of situation where we are extremely worried, you said take a breath.
Yeah.
What else?
So, you know, I have a 9-step process on this in another, for another day, and in another book, but, basically you pause, take a breath. And first thing is you name the emotion, and you give it a granular name, like it's irritated impatience or impatient frustration, And by giving as precise a name as you can, the brain, the part of your brain that uses language, calms down the part of your brain that's suffering. So that's an interesting little trick. Just, okay, this is what I'm feeling. You can journal it. And then there's a number of, there's like several steps you can go, like, what do I need right now that I'm not getting? What is the message of this state? What do I need to learn? What could I do? What do I want to do next? Like, how can I just like bypass it and take a next step and say, I'm going to let this go for the moment. And I'm going to step back into my day. You can change the channel. And that's like going for a walk or watching a fun movie or looking at a nice picture, you know, so that's like just your brain can't have a negative thought and feeling and a positive one at the same moment. So you like click the clicker and say, okay, I'm going to just shift to gratitude right now. Or I'm going to shift. So those are just a few different things you can do. But these are all mapped out now in the mindfulness world. And they're, you know, it really is possible for us to go way past managing stress into turning it into something good.
My favorite word is neuroplasticity. I just love the idea
rewire. Yeah.
It's amazing.
I know. And thank God we live in a time where the scientists discovered that. Like, that wasn't there 20 years ago. Yes. We didn't know that intuition was a part of was a brain process 20 years ago. It was all woo-woo. Now we know which part of the brain does intuition. We know that we can't control it. You actually have to let go control. You have to let your mind wander. That's why creative people don't like structure. And structured people have trouble being creative because you need to take away the structure for the creative brain to come out. So we know all this now. We didn't. And boy, do we need it in today's world, right? I mean, boy, do we need new tools to change ourselves quicker, you know, deal with the unbelievable cascade of, you know, worry and sorrow. And, you know, there's just a lot going on right now.
Margaret, how do we find out more? Follow online, get a copy of the book.
Well, thank you for asking. So the Science of Leadership book is at thescienceofleadership.com, just www.scienceofleadership.com. My personal website is coachmeg.com, and I'm also Coach Meg at LinkedIn. And then my book partner who wrote the coaching case studies, Jeff Hall, is at jeffreyhall.com and also at LinkedIn.
Fantastic. Margaret, thank you so much for being with us, and we would love to have you back to talk about some of those other things.
Thank you, Jim. It's been you're great just letting me riff. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And we'll be right back.
Tired of talk and no action on climate change? Introducing The Real Environmentalists, the bold new book by Jim Beach. It's not about activists, politicians, or professors. It's about the entrepreneurs, real risk takers, building cleaner, smarter solutions, not for applause, but for profit. The entrepreneurs in the book aren't giving speeches. They're in labs, factories, and offices, cleaning the past and building clean products for the future. The Real Environmentalists is available now because the people saving the planet aren't the ones you think. Go to Amazon and search for Real Environmentalists. Thank you.
Welcome back to School for Startups Radio. Hope you're having a great day, and thank you so much for being with us today. I have a special treat for us all now. The famous prankster Alan Abel is with us. He has done some of the greatest pranks that you have ever heard of on a national level, and it's always to prove a point, and you will just be blown away by this. He was on the show about a year ago, and I liked him so much. I said, Alan, we got to get you back on and see what you're doing these days. Sir, welcome back to the show. Thanks for being with us again.
Well, thank you, Jim. Always a pleasure to be with you. And now, is this actually a broadcast? I mean, are we out there in the ether, so to speak, or is this just for your friends and relatives?
You know, we're on 11 AM FM stations and two internet platforms alone that get 75,000 listeners a day. So, you know, I'll tell you, Alan, my wife hasn't listened to a show yet, but there's like 75,000 other suckers that will do it.
Oh, my goodness. Well, that's interesting because it reminds me of my father, who had a general store in a small town in Ohio called Coshocton that hardly anyone has ever heard of. And he never saw one of my performances. And finally, he showed up at the Ohio Wesleyan University, which is in Delaware, Ohio, just north of Columbus. And it was, you know, about 1,200 students, and I had about a 90-minute program that I did, the usual back and forth afterwards and questions and answers. And at the reception afterwards, my dad was with my brother-in-law, the dentist, Stanley, who never really cared for me, which I knew and I had to laugh at because he was a dentist all his life. And and he was telling my dad, well, when is Alan going to get a life? And my dad responded, not realizing I was within earshot, saying, well, Stanley, you saw he was entertaining those people for 90 minutes. What would you do up on stage? Root canals? And Stanley just turned red, white, and blue and walked away. And I had to laugh because, you know, it was the first time my dad ever showed up. And there he is defending me, for heaven's sake, because I always turned down the general store. You know, the idea of taking over that store and selling soups and nuts and outing flannel and cheesecloth, which I could never tell the difference between. I always got confused. In the dry goods department, people go over and I ask them to point to a bolt of cloth and I could sell that. Then what they pointed to, but I just didn't want to sit there and wait for a customer to come in, because that was his whole life, and he loved it. It was what he did all the time, but more power to him. But then finally he came around full circle and said, well, I must be doing something right, because I was getting some good reviews and getting some jobs here and there, recording albums and being on various shows. Back in the 60s, the Ed Sullivan Show, and the Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. In fact, I wanted to get on that show at first and auditioned, and Rudy Tejas, the producer, said, well, we have 5,000 people who want to get on the show. How are you going to get on the show? And I said, well, I don't know. How do I get on the show? He said, well, you have to have a lot of luck. Well, I can't depend on luck, actually, Jim. You know, yes, serendipity when you meet the right person, the right time, whatever. And, you know, I started out as an actor in the 50s, for example, just to digress for a second. And I, Lover's Leap was an NBC show, Circle Armstrong Theater, that I was on with an actress named Grace Kelly. And, you know, she was just an actress then, early 50s. And a beautiful young lady, but I have that proud recollection. I was on a television show. Yes, with Grace Kelly, you know, it's no big deal. It ran a few times and that was the end of it. But neither here nor there. That's the way life goes. But my mother was ill in Columbus in the early 60s, and she said, Alan, how come you don't get on with Johnny Carson? Because you watched the show in the hospital in Columbus, Ohio. And I said, well, I explained to her that, you know, you really can't just get on that show. And she said, well, I want to see you on the show. So I put together a plan whereby I went down to the Waldorf Towers. I had a friend who worked there. And, you know, at the night desk, and he gave me some of their engraved stationery. Now, that hotel is part of the Waldorf Astoria in New York City, where, you know, for one night, you can get a cheap room for about $500. And if you want the Waldorf Towers, maybe a couple of thousand. So I had that stationery that went with the towers, and I had a calligrapher, a friend of mine, write this very, very beautiful letter to Rudy, the producer of The Tonight Show, saying that she was just in town for a few days and she heard this stand-up guy, Alan Abel, do a performance with a private gathering, and you should put him on the show sometime, and I'll call you next time I come back to New York. With love, Linda. No return address, but just on that great stationery and in beautiful handwriting by the calligrapher. Letter went off, and believe it or not, 4 or 5 days later, I got the call from Rudy saying, Alan, can you come in tomorrow and do the show because Jack Benny can't show up? He was supposed to come in from the Los Angeles coast, and he can't make it. I said, well, let me check my schedule. I checked it in 2 seconds and said, yeah, I'll be there.
But
and
Linda, Linda was completely unknown. It was a BS Linda. It could have been any Linda, and the producer just assumed it was the Linda he knew best. Is that the...
Exactly. Exactly.
Oh, brilliant.
Because I did the show, and it went over very well. Carson and I got along, and he invited me back, and I did another show on The Tonight Show a couple of weeks later. And on one of the occasions, I avoided Rudy Tejas, whom I knew by name and had met him a couple of times, but he finally cornered me and says, hey, you've been performing around. Do you know this guy, a gal named Linda? He's driving me nuts. You know, I have about 8 or 9 in my in my black book, but I don't know which one it could be. It was just in New York for a couple of days and stayed at the Waldorf Towers. And of course, I'm very stoic and I take a very straight face. No way I'm going to break that spell. And I'm sorry, Rudy, I can't help you. That was the end of that.
Oh, my goodness. That's hysterical.
I have to laugh because, you know, I've used imagination, Jim. That's the key to my success and many other of my friends in life. Imagination. You know, I've had, when I was in college way back when, I don't want to tell you the years, but then you start doing your math and figure out how young I am, because I think age is a matter of the mind. If you don't mind, it doesn't matter. But I've had people who were like my gophers, and I've watched them succeed in life. They used to bring me coffee when I was doing shows out in Cleveland, Ohio, in the early 50s. And one guy, his name was Roger Ailes, you know, and he'd bring me coffee and a sandwich.
Well, you know what happened to him.
Oh, I sure do. you know, Bill Baker was another one. He became president of NBC, or rather, I'm sorry, I should say NBC, but the station in New York that did all of the NPR-type shows and Channel 13. But, you know, these people, I knew them back when, and I was very grateful to see them go on and become successful, and well, I lost it.
Roger Ailes a good guy?
Oh, yeah. I mean, Roger, and we got along fine, and he managed to book me on a number of shows when he became producer of the Mike Douglas Show, which is a very successful talk show in the 60s.
Ailes was the producer of the Mike Douglas Show?
Oh, yes. Yes, he became. And of course,
this is the guy who founded Fox News, right?
Yeah.
Same guy. Okay.
Yeah, and you know, he was Richard Nixon's advisor on television.
Yes, I remember that.
I don't know what he did about that, the perforation on the, or perspiration, that was a Freudian
slip.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, Roger is always a great guy. We corresponded for a long time, and I interviewed him for a featured article in a magazine called True. It doesn't exist anymore. It's defunct, I believe. But he, you know, he sat for that, and then he went right up the ladder. And now I think he's still there somewhere, off stage, or maybe he's in the wings waiting to come back on. Who knows? You don't know about these people.
Yeah.
But they do go full circle. I haven't seen some people in over 40 years, and then I get the phone call, "Hey, I'm back." And of course, I always pretend to be angry. Well, where have you been 40 years, for heaven's sake? Not even a postcard, a phone call, when you're going to come visit. None of that. How dare you come back into my life, you know? But I'm really very grateful. It is a wonderful feeling. Then our daughter Jennifer, she and her husband Jeff, they did a documentary on all the events that I did along with my wife Jenny, and they covered the whole situation and throughout the years. It's called Abel Raises Cain, which is a documentary that won the first grand prize at Slam Dance, which is the the alternative film festival, out in Park City in Utah. And then also it's one of the best for independent filmmakers. And they won first prize in that festival, and then in Canada, in Vancouver, and then 12 other countries. And I got a chance to go to those other countries like Barcelona, Spain, and represent them, because they were busy out, you know, in Hollywood at that time making movies and stuff. But when I got out to Denmark, everyone had rides bicycles in Denmark. And in Copenhagen there, they won the first prize again, and I had to accept the statuette, beautifully sculptured by a very well-known sculptor whose name I unfortunately forget or couldn't pronounce if I did remember it. It weighed about 30 pounds, and I complained to the 400 or 500 people in that audience at the final night for the prizes that I was going to accept it, but with regrets for the filmmakers, because they already had trophies on, and they don't need another doorstop, and they need the cash. They don't really, really need a trophy like this, but thanks anyhow. And besides, what about those small bicycle seats? I tried to ride a bicycle around Copenhagen, and I had to get preparation H at the end of the day. Are you in collusion with that company? What's going on here, you know? And everybody, of course, laughs at things like that.
Alan, but have you ever had your sanity checked?
Oh, yes. In fact, I had a good friend who was a psychiatrist, His name was Irving Sale on Park Avenue in New York, and we were friends. And I used to tease him and say, I'm never going to lie on your couch and pay you $300 an hour. And I said, well, what would you say? Describe me in two words. He said, a certified nut. You know, but he was a great guy. He passed away a few years ago, of course. But he had celebrity clients, Barbara Streisand, and he had Donald Trump. And speaking of Donald Trump, he once owed me $900 for some books that I sold. And what happened was in front of Trump Tower in New York City that. And he said, the guards chased me away. And they said, well, you can't sell books in front of Trump Tower in New York because the sidewalk belongs to Donald Trump. And I said, wait a minute, what do you mean the sidewalk belongs? Well, they chased me away. You know, they're big guys. They're former linebackers, and you don't mess with those guys. But I went to small claims court and got a judgment for, you know, the money I could have earned in that 2 hours out there on the sidewalk at $900, and I got a default judgment because Donald's lawyers don't show up in court for a $900 type of situation. It's $900 million. Oh, yeah. But so I had this judgment. Now, what do you do with it? Now, in order to collect the money, I had to pick out the corporation that was directly associated with that area of Donald Trump's holdings. And it was a very sticky matter. I couldn't find that. But I knew he owned the Taj Mahal, a hotel in Atlantic City. So I went down there to the sheriff and paid him the $50 to hold an auction to sell the Taj Mahal for my $900. And that made press copy, of course, because my idea was to get the first $900 at the auction and then give him the next $55 million. Well, as soon as that I mentioned that plan, of course, suddenly a $1,000 check appeared to pay for the debt that I was owed. So, you know, it's a good way to do things like that. And it cost me, what, transportation to Atlantic City and $50 for the sheriff. So I believe in using, again, the mind as the last frontier of exploration. But people don't do that. And when I go out and talk to college people particularly, you know, they want to become chairman of the board, you know, after they get their master's degree. And if they have their PhD, they figure like walking in and taking over the company. Well, it doesn't work that way. No way. No way. And I get emails from people all the time say, well, I have this book I want to publish, or I have that plan to do this or that. Can you give me a break? Bob Wilder was a banker, retired out in Colorado, you know, and he had money and he bought, about 500 rocking chairs that the John F. Kennedy used to rock in. Somebody made them and they were in storage gathering dust, couldn't be sold. And this is now in the 70s, of course, and nobody wants to buy a rocking chair for apparently. He advertised in the Wall Street Journal and airline magazines and no sales. And I told him, I said, Bob, he called me, I said, why don't you target grand juries in the Southwest? And from the old photographs, they were sitting in rocking chairs, and there are 23 of them. And you've got the money from the local community in the county to pay for that grand jury rocking chair purchase. Well, he hired salesmen to do that, and he sold all 500. It took him a couple of months, but the grand jury said, yeah, we can meditate. I was going to say meditate, but that was another Freudian slip. Mediate much more proficiently if we're rocking rather than just sitting still. It makes sense. So they're just using ideas like that, you know, can move a product or something else that you want to do. Simple things. When I fly to the coast, as I do occasionally, I always get a three-seater. Now, I need it because I want to sleep when I'm tired. I want to eat when I'm hungry. They don't let you do on that on the air, and they won't give you a three-seater unless you buy three seats, and I can't afford that. So I get one seat, and then when I get a rear window seat, because they always load the plane from the rear first, I put a string in my mouth about a foot long and dangle. Now, people coming over to the two seats next to me, because I always fly off peak and there's a lot of empty seats around, they won't sit next to me because they see a stranger with a string from his mouth, and it discourages friendship. Now, if they still sit down, because some people will just, they don't mind, I don't want to go all the way to California from New York and talk to a John Deere tractor salesman or sit next to a lady with a sick bag in front of her, you know. So then phase two is I put a tampon in my nose, and then I explain that I have a nose and ear problem. I have one in my ear also. And now they will not sit next to me. Nobody will sit next to me. I wouldn't sit next to me. You wouldn't. A guy with a string from his mouth and a tampon in his nose and one in his ear? You got to be crazy, right?
Unbelievable. I love it. How Let's try to be serious for just a second, Alan, if at all possible. I wouldn't be surprised if it's not. What can we use to extrapolate this into our real world trying to fight and build a small business? You know, so you're encouraging us to think very imaginatively and get outside the box. How can we actually gain some of the wildness that you have inherently and use it to better benefit and grow better businesses?
Well, I don't know. I guess you'd have to have a mother that I had, which I love, whom I loved, and she managed to offend just about everybody. But she was very well-spoken. She played piano for silent movies back in those early 30s before the talkies. And, you know, and she also read a lot of books in libraries. She spent many, many hours in the library reading books. And then she would give reviews on radio, and she did that very well. But, you know, she was also encouraging me to become interested in music. And I found the drums because I broke a leg playing football when I was in middle school. I said medical, but that was, again, another Freudian type slip because I thought about medicine, but I'm a little afraid of all those years you have to spend as an intern and as a resident. And then finally, after you've pretty much gone broke paying your schooling, you have to start your own shop or your own business. And of course, I have advocated having doctors post their medical school grade averages in the phone book after their names, so you can tell the good ones from the bad ones, by federal law. In other words, you're driving through Kansas and you have a headache, you look up Dr. Harry Jones, A+, you could trust him with brain surgery.
That's a good idea.
Yeah, right. Well, I have a lot of these kinds of good ideas, but as far as answering your question, where do you start, how do you begin? I think you just have to jump in. It's like learning to swim. You know, you jump in the water and flap around a while, and finally you get the idea that if you lay on your back, you can float, and if you use the crawl, you can swim, and you got to learn how to breathe, and away you go, you know, like a fish. And you have to do that for a while, and you may sink for a while, too, and get water in your lungs, and you learn very quickly that's not the way to swim. But I don't do bungee jumping. I wouldn't jump out of an airplane. I have friends who do that every week. You know, they go out, they jump out and fly through the air with a parachute. They have a reserve chute. And it's a shame that those people who unfortunately died with the Twin Towers didn't have these parachutes, these small tandem chutes, you know, because they could float down from the 30th floor. That's all they would need, on up, all those floors and all those people who had ended up jumping without a parachute.
Yeah.
And we've got so many tall buildings, there should be mandatory parachutes like the kind that they come down when you see them at a sporting event.
Yeah, sure.
They're very small. They roll up very easily, and anyone can hold on and jump out and land safely. This is a crazy time. You know, the money's there. Why don't we get it? Why don't we do it? Well, look, we're still a free country, and we all have what we have to say and do in the works. And if you want to say something that's against the grain, so to speak, a free press belongs to the people who own one. I don't know who said that, but it pretty much sums up, you know, how to get around things. And I once ran for political office in Congress, as a matter of fact, when I Stuart B. McKinney was a congressman from Connecticut who passed away, unfortunately, in office way back in the late 80s, and they needed to fill 3 months of his term. So I went in as an independent candidate, and I went down to Washington and measured the office in case I would redecorate if I won. And, you know, I campaigned there for a while, and I tried all different ways of getting votes. I cleaned all the toilets on Metro North commuter trains, had my 20 volunteers come in with Lysol and fresh towels and bars of soap and people on the train. One guy ran up and down the aisle, said, "Go look at the toilet. You won't believe it. Look at the toilet." They thought he was nuts, but they went in there and found out that it was an absolutely beautiful, beautifully clean toilet that my people had done for votes. Well, it didn't help. I lost by a landslide. But nevertheless, I had 3 months of running for office. It was a lot of fun. And also very tiring, shaking all those hands and eating all those rubber chicken, those dinners of, you know, it's a lousy life. And then I said, if I did win, my first act of duty in office would be to resign. There's no way I'm going to go to Congress. And, you know, I admire people like Al Franklin. He went all the way, and he's still there as a senator, and good for him. He was a stand-up comic, as you probably remember.
Right, yep. And some of my favorite movies ended up in the ape suit in Trading Places.
Yes, okay.
Alan, can you solve some of the problems in the Middle East?
Well, I did have a project, and it's on hold right now because there's such a quagmire, there's so much mayhem for Syria. A fellow came to me from Washington, D.C. He was in the Gulf War, and he had made some money into the situation where it was left to him by his uncle, favorite uncle, who had money and left it to him. And he wanted to do something about Syria, where they have this incredible problem with the, you know, Bashar al-Assad, who is a genocidal maniac, killing people at random. Well, and elsewhere, I don't know, let's not even talk about ISIS. And what my suggestion was that he send in 750 mercenaries, heavily armed, and announce that he's going to do that, and then take a video of these men in training and uniform, in combat uniforms, with all these machine guns and mortars and weapons that, you know, are used in all kinds of warfare, and then put the video on television in Syria. So that was the plan that's in the works. And, of course, we only had 12 actors who looked mean in uniform with the guns, and they kept going around the circle in the woods and coming out until we counted
750
times.
Excellent.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Alan,
so just, yes.
I love having you on. Unfortunately, we have run out of time. Thank you so much for being with us. How can people get and watch Alan or Abel Raising Cain?
Oh, that's just go to that website, Abel Raises Cain. It's up there, and it tells you all the information, or alanabel.com, and gives the info, A-L-A-N-A-B-E-L, and please spell my name correctly. You can do that, you know. And one last quickie, if I may have time, you may or may not use it, but
sure.
I was a percussionist for a while. People say, what did you ever do to earn money? And I explained that I was a professional percussionist in New York City at Radio City Music Hall. And between shows, you know, I'd go out to my little office and get on the phone and do all kinds of things I had to do between shows. And we did four a day, and it was a long job, but I enjoyed it. And then I formed a percussion ensemble, six drummers playing timpani, chimes, bells, vibes, xylophone. And I made a tape of this, and this is going back into the 60s now. And I wanted to get a recording contract, and I got turned down by every record company, and there were a lot of them. I think there were 15 or 20. And then I figured, well, that's not the way to sell a new idea for percussion music. What I would do is send them on a tour and then send back glowing reviews to the people, arts and repertoires people in each record company. So to make a long story short, I did. I sent the percussion, first percussion sextet, on a non-existent tour, and then every week I'd send a press release to RCA Victor, MGM Records, Columbia Records, all of them claiming they played at this particular college or this particular town, the audience loved it, and this happened and that happened. And finally I get the phone call from George Avakian, and at that time he was with RCA Victor, and he said, I want that group to play, and I want to record them, and I'll give you a contract for two albums, and he did. So, we had two albums that went out, and they did very well at that time because it was the first for percussion music, but I had the satisfaction and the pleasure of taking this idea from scratch and making it happen, all with just imagination, and that's the key to everything. And if life is not a great adventure, it is nothing. Helen Keller said those words, Jim, and she was both blind and deaf.
I love it. Alan, thank you so much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
We are out of time, but back tomorrow. Be safe, take care, and go make $1 million. Bye now.